of the agenda today is a briefing from the Urban Forestry Program.
We have Jen Cairo here.
Welcome.
Thank you. I think you can put it inside there, on the side of the monitor.
Oh, great.
And I am going to pass out a letter that I received from Hosford Abernathy.
Thank you. And let it show just that Commissioner Kristen Miner has returned to the commission. Okay, go ahead.
Great. Good afternoon, commissioners. Thanks for having me here. I'm Jen Cairo. I'm the city forester and the urban forestry program manager. And my address is 10910 North Denver Avenue, Portland, 97217. So today, I wanted to accomplish two things. One is just a general overview of urban forests and the services they provide to cities, and some further information about Portland's version of urban forestry and what our group does. And I think there's some areas that have overlapping interest for the Historic Landmarks Commission. So the intent behind that is to share information, but maybe also spur some future discussions or areas of interest that you might want to hear more about and we could bring back to you. And the second item is to talk very briefly about the Ladd's Addition Conservation District guidelines and their status currently. So please feel free to ask any questions that you like through the conversation or through my presentation. First, urban forestry is, some people think, a relatively new concept. I think most people think of forests as out there in the wilds, large, expansive, solid masses of trees. Urban forestry has actually been in a practice area, concentration in forest management, for several decades now. And the rationale behind that is that tree services in some ways are very localized. For example, if you think about shade and temperatures in the summer, if you stand under a tree and then step out from under the tree, you can feel the difference. It's pretty dramatic and very local. So with that concept in mind, we've recognized over the past decades that trees in cities are part of our essential infrastructure to keep everyone healthy in a city or help them be healthy, and also connect communities. And I'll talk a little bit about those benefits in a little while. We also see here that we have an increasing amount of people living in urban areas, therefore an increasing amount of people on the planet should be benefiting or need urban forest benefits. Here's a picture from 1857 of, yes, Portland. This is on this side of the river, actually probably not far south from this area, looking north, and hence we got our name, our moniker of Stumptown. And so when we think about trees in Portland, I think the sense nationwide is that we're a very green city and progressive in terms of our green elements, including trees, and maybe most remarkably trees. However, with European settlement of the area, we see that was not the case. And so when people talk about old growth trees in Portland, that's usually not the case, usually not true. And then there's roughly the same view more recently, and you see there's a lot more buildings, of course. You can see the Willamette in the background again, and of course more trees. And these data here will be updating in the next year, but we know some things about what our forest consists of in Portland and what it does for all of us who live here. So currently we have 220,000 street trees of many different types. Those are trees that are located on public property, usually adjacent to a sidewalk, so right along the street. And there are also roughly more than 1.2 million park trees. The city's parks properties contain the majority of the city's tree canopy. There's also many private property trees. We're not sure how many of those we actually have. We're conducting a study right now that'll give us a decent estimate, but we think it's around the 1.2 million mark. So a very significant amount of trees are on private property. And from these and some analyses that we can do, we estimate that the structural value of the urban forest is $5 billion. So what that means is if we were to lose all of our trees and try to replace the value of the services we get from those trees, that's what it would cost us to do that. That comes down to about $27 million in benefits each year for the city, for our residents. And given what our official budget is for urban forest management, we enjoy much greater returns than we do in dollar investment. And I mentioned those services, so here is a slide showing you a scattering of some of the services that we enjoy. I mentioned cooling, shade, there's also walkability. There's many studies these days about traffic safety and traffic, reducing traffic speeds and buffering to make neighborhoods more walkable in terms of safety as well as being enjoyable. There's also a lot of research that is not that new. We just keep adding to it about health and reducing stress, expediting recovery times for people who are ill or in hospitals, and reducing environmental stresses in an urban environment on people that helps lengthen their lives and improve the quality of life. And another area I wanted to point out up on the right side, climate change. So Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is an astrophysicist, he's at the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, recently did a reboot of Cosmos, which was pretty well received. And one of the comments that he made in explaining the timeline of our planet and the billions of years that it's taken for Earth to get to this point is that a critical juncture was trees becoming populous enough to create enough oxygen for those of us who breathe oxygen to exist on the planet. So trees are really critical for all of our lives, anything that is an aerobic being. There's a recent study in relation to climate change and development, just in April of 2018 by the Forest Service. Researchers are Novak and Greenfield. And they reported that cities in the US are losing 36 million trees each year. And pavement and impervious areas are increasing remarkably. So that was put out as a notification that these trees that we need in cities are experiencing losses, something for us to be aware of and perhaps focus on. And the last thing I'll mention in regards to climate change and future forest benefits is a publication called Nature in 2015. A researcher by the name of Crowther projected that in 300 years, given the current tree removal rates globally and tree planting rates, we will not have trees left. So this becomes in our work, these are driving messages behind everything that we're doing in Portland in terms of policy and maintenance of trees, and also messaging, what we tell people about trees and help them engage with tree canopy and hopefully preserve it and protect it. Which leads to our mission, to preserve and ensure the urban forest and the services it provides for current and future generations of Portland residents. The city has many plans that pertain to trees in the city. The most important in our work is our guiding document, the Urban Forest Management Plan. The most recent iteration of that was in 2007. An action plan was created. It distilled the 2004 management plan. So that's a little bit old. It's actually over 10 years old now. We're hoping to start a process next year to renew that and update it. You see here other plans that include trees in some way as part of their goals for, again, those services that the trees give all of us who live here in the city. Focusing again on the Urban Forest Action Plan, there are three primary goals. These are the guiding principles behind our urban forestry program and ideally behind tree regulations in the city as well. The first is to protect, preserve, restore, and expand Portland's urban forest, again, for those services that trees provide to all of us. The second, to promote understanding and stewardship of the urban forest. We rely very much on residents to understand and practice good stewardship of trees in the city in order to enjoy those benefits going forward. And goal three is to provide equitable tree benefits for all residents in the city. Our tree canopy is not equally distributed across the city, so some folks enjoy greater returns than others, and that's been a pattern for quite a few years now that we're working to try to change. I'm going to shift a little bit into how our program areas are structured, and just again, more information for you folks about what we do and what resources we may have that are of interest to you and applicable in your work. So at the core of what we do is the science of forest management, and that's tree physiology and dendrology. It's also social science behind that. From that stems, ideally, policy and regulations around how trees are planted, retained, removed, managed in the city. We also have an operations function, that is people physically doing tree work. And then we have education and outreach, again, connecting people with the city's regulations. So do they know what they need to know? Do they need a permit? Things as basic as that, up to helping people understand all the benefits that we all get from trees in our neighborhoods. I'm gonna talk a little bit about the science part right now, and I'm focusing on certain areas just for the sake of time, and also that are germane to the LADS Edition Conservation Guideline districts later on. So one of the science areas that we work on is assessing the city's canopy. The amount of tree cover is a metric that's used in many of those documents you saw on a previous slide. The city's goal is a 33% canopy cover that was derived in 2004. So the goal itself is a little bit older and at some point may need to get revisited. But these studies are some of the ways that we determine where we're at in terms of that goal. Right now, we're at 30.7%. And again, 33% is the goal. So we're looking to increase more as per the city's policies. We also look at what our forest is made of. What are the trees? What types of trees are where? And I'll speak more to that in a moment. That's part of tree canopy monitoring. What changes do we see? Where are there more trees, fewer trees? We also have done a potential tree canopy study just more recently and determined after reducing areas that are known to be unbuildable, we've determined that potential tree canopy in the city could be as high as in the mid 50%. Remember again, the goal currently is 33%. And we're currently working on a planting strategy, a citywide planting strategy really geared at that equity goal, to see if we can't increase canopy services in the low-income, low-canopy neighborhoods where we're currently deficient. Okay, I'm going to drill down into one aspect of forest management for you here. Remember I was talking about monitoring the forest, what it's made of, what kinds of trees are where in the city. So periodically, there are pests and pathogens, diseases that affect trees. Some of those affect many types of trees. Some of those are more specific to certain trees. Historically, what we've seen in the U.S., there's two examples here, that looking east, since trade originated from European culture from the East Coast, we've seen a lot of these diseases spread from the east to the west. So if we look east, we see that many communities in the U.S. have been impacted by emerald ash borer. That's the photo on the left. And the example there is from Toledo, Ohio. And another one that you may have heard of, Dutch elm disease, which we do have in Portland. We don't have emerald ash borer yet in Portland. And why these are important in our work is knowing what species are going to be affected and how likely that is to happen. It's our responsibility to manage our forest to try to prevent tree losses when these things happen. So, for example, right now we're doing a lot of inoculation of elm trees that are susceptible to Dutch elm disease to try to prolong their lives. We're also not planting as many susceptible elm trees because their prognosis isn't good. Same thing with ash. We're not planting a lot of those these days for the same reason. And I'll show you the results here of an infestation. So on the left, Toledo, Ohio, this is post-emerald ash borer infestation. You can see there are green trees there, so it is growing season. It's not winter, but all those leafless trees are dead. And now that's a huge loss for that community, a great difference for the people who live there, who likely loved having those trees. It's also quite a cost and potential public safety hazard to have those dead trees along the street. And boy, to get that many trees back is going to take decades. And on the right, we have a similar situation, but a different pathogen, Dutch elm disease. So one of the things we manage for is diversity of species, so that when something that attacks a certain species comes to town, we basically don't have all of our eggs in one basket. The losses are far less impactful, and we actively work on that. And this is one of the ways we do that is through our street tree inventory. This is how we know that we have 220,000 street trees. We had 1,300 very engaged and energetic tree stewards in their neighborhoods. We taught to do the inventory, and they did all that documentation with 98% accuracy. And one of the things you see on the lower right, that pie chart, is we looked at what species we have. Again, to help us figure out what we need to do to make sure our forest is more resilient given the pests and pathogens that we know are coming our way. And you'll see maples comprise a really large component of our urban forest. And as a result of the survey and that information, we no longer permit maple tree planting on streets, at least until we've seen a change in that number. We're very, very susceptible right now to something called Asian longhorn beetle, which devastates maples, among other trees. Am I doing okay? Anybody have any questions or anything yet? Okay. So here's an example, also an output of the street tree inventory. It's the Hollywood neighborhood. And everything here that has a red dot is a tree, street tree. We're not looking at private property trees or park trees in this case, but a street tree that will be lost if emerald ash borer and Asian longhorn beetle come to town. So these are species that will be affected by those. So that's looking at roughly half of the trees in that community. And again, that'll be quite a remarkable negative impact on the folks who live there, a great cost to manage, and again, decades until we get trees back that are of decent size, which some of these would be.
How far away right now is the emerald ash or Asian longhorn beetle from Portland?
Good question.
And what is basically their progress over time?
Yeah, okay. Well, emerald ash borer is in the Midwest now. It's worked its way from the East Coast. Right now in places like Connecticut and New York, they had a really heavy outbreak probably 2 years ago now, and it's very remarkable just driving along the roads. They're dead trees and pretty much count on the fact that it's an ash that was infected with it. Asian longhorn beetle has been more, so in other words, it's coming our way, and APHIS and USDA Forest Service have been tracking those, and there are quarantines on moving wood because of the risk of spreading emerald ash borer further. And once you have it, it's really hard to stop. So the idea is to keep it out if at all possible, or diversify your forests so that when it comes, which it is likely to do, the impacts will be less. Asian longhorn beetle has had a different pattern. It's been more spots around the country. According to APHIS, we are, Portland, number two on the susceptibility list, given the high volume of imports that come into our city from Asian locations where the longhorn beetle is native. And there have been two infestations in Portland, two sightings that were contained in shipyards, which is amazing when you look at APHIS inspects something like 2% of all the shipping material that comes in. But there were Asian longhorn beetles found in wooden packing material. So that's something we're really concerned about. Asian longhorn beetles also what we call a broad spectrum pest. It doesn't just focus on one tree, it focuses on a few different species. Its favorite is maple, though. And as you saw, 28% of our street trees would be lost if we got Asian longhorn beetle in. Does that help answer that question?
Yeah, it does.
Thanks. Okay, shifting into regulations. So one of the roles that our group plays in the city, one of our responsibilities, is tree permitting and regulation. In 2015, the city replaced its outdated, old, sometimes confusing, tree regulations with Title 11 trees. according to Title 11, urban forestry's responsibilities are to implement the tree code for all city and street trees. City trees are those that are on city properties, so in a park or near a BES pump station, anything of that nature. And urban forestry is also responsible for private property trees that are 12 inches diameter breast height, which is about as big as a dinner plate, or larger when there's no development present. By responsible, I mean if a permit is required according to the code, our group is the one that's responsible for implementing those permit requirements. Our partner in implementing the city's tree regulations is the Bureau of Development Services. Specifically, BDS is responsible for implementing tree regulations on private properties when the tree is 12 inches or larger, so again, dinner plate or bigger, at about four and a half feet off the ground, when development is present, when there's ground disturbing activity. When there's not, it's urban forestry's role. You don't need to remember any of that because, we set up back in 2015 what we called the single point of contact for tree questions and issues in the city. So if you're curious about a tree being removed in your neighborhood, is it permitted or not, or need to find out if you need a permit, please call before you cut. 823-TREE is our number, or you can email trees@portlandoregon.gov. And we have a website with many pages about permit requirements and those reports that I've mentioned before, including the street tree inventory. So going back to the street tree inventory and the photos that you saw of Dutch elm disease and emerald ash borer, one of the policy tools that we use to implement the city's codes are these approved street tree lists. And again, I'm giving you like one example of the science and forest management that we use. These are all on our website, and these are lists of tree species that are, so to speak, pre-approved to be planted in rights of way. And they're organized by the space, how large the space on the ground is, as well as are there overhead power lines. Overhead power lines clearly don't work well with trees, so we have shorter trees on those lists. The idea is when you need to, you're required to by code, or want to plant a street tree, you would choose one from these lists. Or you can propose something similar and our tree inspectors will approve it or not. But again, here we have the science informing our policy, and the intent behind this is to give us a resilient forest that will not suffer catastrophic losses when the next critter comes to town. Switching gears, one of our other program areas that may interest you is the Heritage Tree Program. Excuse me. The city of Portland has just over 300 heritage trees. These are designated by council because they have special importance, either for their arboricultural value, their historic value, their unique size for their species or shape. And you see there's an interactive map on our website, actually, with a full inventory. And if you wanted to go touring the heritage trees, you could do that. And the tree on the right, does anyone know where that is?
Is that the PSU campus?
You got it. That's the library, the PSU library. And that's heritage tree number 54. It's a Fagus sylvatica, which is a European beech. And I like to show this picture because, to me, this is a great way to do development. When you're a person who's trying to get trees in the city, building around big, nice trees that have a long life ahead of them when you can is a positive. So the Heritage Tree Program, an area I wanted you to know about in case that is of interest to your group. And our next area is operations. This is the tree work. We have arborists, skilled arborists, climbing arborists, and a lot of heavy equipment that perform tree work all over the city. And there are two examples here of large tree removals. The photo on the left, way up top, that little thing is a person who climbed up there to work on that removal, which was in Washington Park near the new reservoir. And we also, photo on the left, do that kind of work 24/7 for any tree emergencies in city rights of way. Dramatic picture. That doesn't happen that much, thankfully. But our folks are on call at all times, and when there is a tree that is threatening the right-of-way or the sidewalk, part of the right-of-way, or has already fallen, we will come out and take care of that. Two winters ago, we were very, very busy doing that kind of thing, thanks to the winter weather. The photo on the upper right is an example of a Dutch elm disease inoculation in progress, and on the lower right is tree planting, which we do a lot of all over the city as well. So again, these are examples of what our tree work crew, our operations crews do. And our final area is education and outreach. Again, this is these are some samples of the programs that we have. Learning Landscapes is focused on schools and planting trees with students. And it's usually elementary school students, sometimes high school, and there's a curriculum component that goes with it. Each year we usually plant around 70 trees in different schoolyards. That's not as impressive a number as the number of kids who participate, which is always upwards of 600, who are learning something about trees and getting hands-on experience with trees. And this program is also funded in a way through Title 11, through the tree regulations. When there are mitigation fees paid, instead of a required tree planting, we use those funds for this program. Another example is the volunteer tree planting and care programs. We offer a series of workshops each winter, on the order of 20 to 30 of those, that teach planting, pruning, heritage tree walks, things of that nature, just to connect people with their neighborhood trees, people in their community who care about trees, to give them some knowledge that they can apply, teach them about permits, and have them engage with their forest and the services they get from that forest. In Portland, unlike a lot of the country, the adjacent street tree to a property is that property owner's responsibility to maintain. And that's pretty challenging for a lot of people. So these programs in part are geared towards helping give them the tools and information to do that well, or at least know that they have that responsibility. And here are some other workshop examples. There's a pruning workshop up on the left. We do quite a few tree walks just educating about different species so people can understand what they might want in their yard or in their planting strip.
And what does adjacent mean exactly? You know, if there's a sidewalk and then there's a...
Good question. Adjacent is the property where it abuts the city or public right-of-way. So whomever owns that property. For example, my neighborhood park is Arbor Lodge Park. So adjacent to Bryant Avenue on Arbor Lodge Park, Portland Parks and Recreation is the property owner who's responsible for those street trees. And oftentimes there are trees that are in a grassy strip that is between the curb and the sidewalk.
And that would be the property owner's
responsibility. As per code, from before Title 11, it's been around for a long time.
So if a branch falls from that tree onto a car, it's the property owner's responsibility. They could get sued for that.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So this is why we have outreach programs. Many people, we have a challenge when people knowing who we are and what we do and about permit requirements. So that's one of the areas that these types of workshops are focused on, as well as other things that we do. And we have, it's not just us by a long shot. We're a relatively small group. We work with many stakeholders and partners happily to get the word out and get good practices out there. And here you see examples of some of those. One of those on the lower left is our Urban Forestry Commission. They're somewhat analogous to you folks. They're established by city code and they predate code from the 1970s, actually. And their responsibilities are five basic responsibilities spelled out here. When the Urban Forest Management Plan is updated, they are a major contributor to that. They also provide input on plans, policies, projects that pertain to trees, and their goals in doing that are to ensure that we're meeting the Urban Forest Management Plan goals. They also advise on our budget, and they give recommendations to City Council on tree code amendments and other amendments that affect trees. Heritage tree nominations, again, heritage trees are named by council, and the Heritage Tree Committee of the Commission brings those forward with the help of staff for council consideration. And they also look at other city bureau budgets that might impact the urban forest. And finally, they give an annual report each year. They're required to by code of what they've worked on. Okay, that concludes the very quick overview of urban forestry, Portland's forest, and our urban forestry program. Before I shift gears, does anyone have any questions, observations?
Just a quick question about how other cities are dealing with kind of the similar set of pest issues on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Is everyone taking a similar approach in terms of the diversification of their forestry program and, you know, kind of overtaking other goals, such as for in historic areas, you know?
Yes, good question again. And yes, that is what pretty much everyone is doing. There's actually some standards out there for how to get more resilient species diversity in city plantings. 10-20-30 rule basically says you should have no more than this percentage of trees in this genus and that percentage in this species. We're having to look at that a little more carefully with climate change. We are seeing impacts of that, but the guidelines still hold. And yes, all communities that have forestry programs pretty much use those. And that's a good segue. So the second part of my presentation was to talk about the LADS edition conservation district guidelines. So first off, you folks, I'm sure, are somewhat familiar with the conservation district guidelines. They're from 1988. So I think I have heard that there are areas beyond my particular tree responsibilities that might need updating. Things that jump out to us in urban forestry about the 1988 guidelines are that there are actually required species that are to be planted on particular streets. And this is out of a desire to have an historic characteristic forever after that makes LADS Edition the special place that it is. So here's an example of three of the species that are required as to be planted in streets there. Norway maple. Norway maple is a nuisance species. It's been on the city's nuisance species list for several years now, so it cannot be planted according to other city codes because it is a prolific seed producer and it spreads. Typical nuisance species, weed species. American elm, so I spoke about that earlier. These are gorgeous big trees. Unfortunately, Dutch elm disease does a very thorough job of wiping them out at great tragic emotional loss to people as well as cost to property owners and the city. And also European white birch, which in the past 3 years, we've seen a marked uptick in something called the bronze birch borer. And I focused before on emerald ash borer and Dutch elm disease. There are many pests and pathogens affecting urban forests that we need to be aware of and manage for. This is one of them, the birch borer. And they'll move down. It's a bug, and it kills a tree. And if you have especially white birches, you can really see there's a rusty color around the holes in the tree, and they'll move right down a row of birches. So those streets that have these trees on them in LADS Edition and elsewhere are at very significant risk of high tree loss. And some of these species, Norway maple, we just aren't allowed to plant either. I'm not going to go into the details on the tree parts of the guidelines beyond that. This is just an overarching information to ask you if we could not work on updating the guidelines at some time in the near future. And again, my understanding from our colleagues in Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is that there are other factors not related to trees that warrant perhaps some new attention in the guidelines. But we at least would like to have this open it up and have the conversation about what the guidelines should have in them presently and have them allow us to be a little more responsive to sustainable forest needs. Guess where that is? LADS Edition, back before Portland was known for its trees. And here's from the other direction, the view today. It's a really remarkable area in terms of trees. And if you haven't been able to go there, I highly recommend going there in the summer, especially when the leaves are on, because it's quite gorgeous. We look at this as kind of a model for other parts of the city to try to get this extent of canopy in neighborhoods that currently don't enjoy this much tree cover or all the services that are provided in a resilient form. And that is all I have. I have any questions?
I have a question about size of trees, and especially in LADS Edition, whether there are a lot of sort of minimally sized street, what are they called, planting strips?
Mm-hmm.
Because I saw that you definitely have different species that are appropriate for various size planting strips. Mm-hmm. And I you know, I think it's so important to make sure that we still have some of our largest trees represented as part of the canopy. So I'm just wondering if you can talk about, you know, how much variation there is in Lad's Edition, and also, well, let's just leave it at that.
Okay. Our goal is to, as we say, maximize the planting space. So clearly, we don't want trees that are going to be too large when they mature in too small a space, because that means the tree will, in all likelihood, have to come out well before it should have, before its natural decline and death. It also creates a lot of infrastructure conflicts like sidewalk lifting and trip hazards and things like that. So it is a standard forest management practice in cities to try to size the species, and we're thinking at maturity, not when it's planted, for the appropriate space. When it comes to what strip sizes are in Lad's Edition, I can't really speak well to that. Mm-hmm. Based on the species that are here, one would, and I know that there are some large planting strips that are housing American elms. It is not uncommon, though, for large older trees to be in spaces that are too small, because that idea of sizing the tree for the space is only about 35, 40 years old. And many trees were planted before that time, or even today, are planted without permits, so therefore they don't have the guidance of what tree is appropriate for the space.
I have a question. Do you have, because the idea that you're presenting is that we have to somehow replace this kind of required trees and Lad's Edition, and I'm assuming not only Lad's Edition, but other historic districts probably on the area. I'm thinking, yeah, you were talking about the width of the trunk, and how are you gonna achieve that big canopy that you have there that you see as a goal, but with a smaller, tinier tree? Is that something that you think it will be possible with another species?
Mm-hmm. So there's two answers to that. Without knowing the details of what the planting strip widths are specifically in Lad's Edition, I can just generalize that I'm pretty sure there are some that are large and could take larger form trees. Also, there are a lot of new construction concepts, design concepts for rights of way, and they're new in practice in Portland more than they are in other places in the U.S., where if there is limited space and the desire is to have larger form trees, the space can be made either through pervious or rubber pavement, bump outs, wows. Bureau of Transportation has gotten pretty good at what they call a wow, which is they go around the tree, they cut out some of the sidewalk, they make more space for it that way. And there's also a number of structural soil and suspended pavement type designs that are being used to create more space for trees where it's limited. The other part or answer to that question is there are many, many tree species out there. As a matter of fact, the nursery industry is always making new tree concoctions. Many of them hybrids and cultivars that are specifically geared towards the difficult urban habitat that trees have to deal with. And so there's just a lot more options out there for things that require less rooting space, but still have height and canopy.
And a quick question too. So this is a very specific so Lad's Edition is, I think, so historic neighborhoods cover, 3% of all of Portland's in Lad's Edition. Are there any other historic neighborhoods that require certain trees? I don't know.
You mean through their guidelines?
Yeah, like this. I'm just wondering, I mean, if we're eliminating all these other species that are prone to infection and littering and other issues, I mean, I guess the question is, I'm just curious if, I mean, it's going to be basically just this one neighborhood with these types of trees. I mean, are they going to be prone to infection if we don't have those trees anywhere else? Are those bugs going to come in? I mean, I don't know.
Well, yes. Yeah. You've hit the nail on the head, right? So the way trees are currently distributed, the species are distributed in Ladd's edition, again, by design to get a certain aesthetic, is that it will be a row, a long row of a particular species, for example, American elms. And you can see that when you talk to the residents there, they've seen it play out over the past decade, two decades, where Dutch elm disease comes to a street, and over the next couple seasons, we lose those large elms. And then there are other parts of the city that have that same issue. I have not done a study of the conservation district guidelines across the city. We do use our street tree inventory. So in areas where there aren't guidelines like this, we are managing for that, the inventory findings. Where we see that there is a predominance of a single tree, we're trying to diversify it now. That's not as easy to do in Ladd's edition.
And that was my question. If you guys are eliminating it everywhere else, then why worry about this one? Because mm-hmm. you're going to basically have a handful of that one type of tree in 100 years, let's say, and won't be. Anyway, it's just an isolated little area of these tree types, which, yeah. Anyway.
It's probably, I would say it's more pronounced here because it was, for very good reasons, intentionally designed to have, you know, this street is just this species and that street is just that species, whereas very few other places, I'm going to venture to say, in the city had that intentional a design in terms of tree species. It's been more happenstance, and therefore it is coincidentally often more diverse.
Yeah, I know that. I think it was the same with all of the different Ladd developments, like Laurelhurst, Eastmoreland, and Ladd's Addition. They all had, they were taking their trees from the nursery, from the Ladd nursery. So they, I think they all had, to a degree, a design ethic that was focused on, you know, it was almost like a wayfinding where you could tell if you were on a north, south, east, west street based upon the species of tree that you had.
So cool.
Mm-hmm. So I think that that's what, and I think that my biggest concern is trying to diversify the forestry within, you know, any of those areas. When it was the design ethic for the period to stay within a certain way to read, is just a way to read the landscape, and so that's why there's, you know, there's the side of me that wants to be on the sustainable and understand the climate change side, but then there's also this other component of me that's like, this is you know, the landscape legacy, that yes, we have these species that will eliminate it, but is there, you know, what is the risk and over time? And I think that the awareness for these types of issues that have been raised, the Cultural Landscape Foundation has placed a heavy emphasis on Ladd's Addition and the street trees there as being threatened. For a variety of different reasons, not only just, you know, the desire to diversify the canopy, but also the species being used. And the fact that Ladd's Addition is a good candidate to be a National Historic Landmark too. It's not just it's a National Register district right now, but it's been mentioned several times by the National Park Service as being having a high potential to be a National Historic Landmark. So it's something that we don't want to necessarily threaten by taking a stance when it comes to the landscape. We have to be very thoughtful, I think, in terms of the solution that we come up with. But, you know, I think that this commission is certainly, you know, dedicated to the idea of working through this type of an issue. So, but I wanted to throw the door back open to you guys to talk about.
Did have another question, like, was it the American elm? That's the really big one. So here's another question. Are there tree species that look exactly like the American elm, right? And smell like, but are not the American elm, but, and don't have all the issues? I don't know.
Yeah.
Or can, because then potentially say you can only use X elm species when you're replacing your American elm. I don't know
Right. Good question. I was actually going to bring something like that up with Commissioner Renzetta's comments. But yeah, what's practiced these days is it's about the character. So we would look for species that keep that historic character of the American elm, for example. And there are options out there. And again, there are a always new options coming out of nurseries. So same thing with Norway maples. There's other species that are not nuisance species that look a lot like the Norway elm and can be used. So that is an idea that I didn't get down to that level in this presentation, but that's an idea that we've seen practiced elsewhere. So in other words, you keep that historic characteristic and image and value, national recognition or what have you, but also get the species resilience. And also it's really important to get back to the fact that, you know, we're losing the American elms now. The others, the European white birch, will be lost in that neighborhood. So I think it's important to think about too, what's the impact of the community? You know, that neighborhood is known for and valued for its remarkable street trees and the aesthetic they provide. We are losing that currently and need to do something for the long term that's a little bit well thought out.
Okay. I have one more question before. I know you have testifiers, but so your question really is, you know, can we update? And by that, are you looking for kind of a collaborative group, you know, to work with urban forestry from the Landmarks Commission? Or are you looking for, you know, you had a whole bunch of partners, Friends of Trees, and, you know, I know there are a lot of folks out there who can also participate. So I guess I'm just looking for what you are envisioning.
Great. It's my understanding is that Bureau of Planning and Sustainability would be the lead bureau on something like this. So really, my request to you is just, is this something that you would be interested in promoting to get looked at sometime in the near future? But how exactly that process plays out, we, of course, would be involved for the tree part. But really, I would be deferring to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for their lead on it and them figuring out a process. I think there's ample room for a lot of stakeholder engagement, and that's a model that we use regularly in urban forestry with our partners as well as residents and property owners in neighborhoods. So, of course, we'd be interested in doing that.
Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to note that I think there's a lot of agreement that the guidelines should be updated just because of their age. But another aspect of this and how much collaboration between the Landmarks Commission and Urban Forestry goes into the update of any new guidelines should consider the fact that we currently don't review alterations or removals to street trees through historic review. So there's actually no point at when we would apply these guidelines to street trees because they're in the right of way. And we review changes to private development or development within property boundaries unless they are non-standard in the right of way. So that's sort of a weird nuance of it's sort of like this is a lost set of guidelines.
So just out of curiosity, like, let's say, and I don't know the answer, so let's say they do update these guidelines that you're not mandated to do any sort of specific street tree. You can do whatever you want. Who does the update and who approves that and say, yeah, that's cool. You can go ahead and, I don't know.
So street tree planting as per city code is regulated and implemented by urban forestry.
But I mean, would, for example, where are these guidelines, the LADS edition conservation district guidelines? So if I go in and I want to replace my street tree, mm-hmm. and I say, you know, I want to put in, I don't know, a fir tree instead of the American elm, mm-hmm. and at what point do I get stopped and told that, no, you can't because of the conservation guidelines?
Yeah, urban forestry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we try to adhere to these, and it's case by case as much as we can, although, you know, we're not allowed, for example, to permit planting Norway maples because they're on the nuisance list, which is why cleaning these up would be really beneficial for us. Because it's difficult. Instead of having a agreed upon policy that's been through a public process and the city is all on board with, these are one-off cases that come up that our staff are always in a difficult position about what to do in that case.
So, Hillary, I assume if the scope of the changes was pretty limited to these, we would still have to go through the process of, right. You know, we recommend and then City Council approves changes because it's a guidelines document.
The PSC.
Okay.
But yes.
Okay.
I mean, there's also the alternative that it could be a street tree plan and it's taken out of the guidelines since the Design Historic Resource Review Team doesn't implement that section. So I don't know if that's the right area or the right document for this guidance to be in. So that's something as we continue this conversation, like what is the proper place for that guidance?
I've got just one more question before we get to the public testimony part. And that, I mean, from the Norway maple perspective, it being a nuisance species because it's a prolific cedar, what kind of a threat does it really have within the urban matrix? I mean, Ladd's addition tends to be, you know, I mean, a tree doesn't just grow spontaneously in kind of an urban area unless you're near a park. Or, you know, I don't typically think of trees just all of a sudden sprouting up people's yards because they mow and they're, you know, trying to keep up with their property and stuff. So within the context of the Norway maple, why would that be not permissible in Ladd's addition as opposed to elsewhere?
So I'm going to give two components to that answer. Okay. One is that the bureau that's responsible for nuisance plant lists in the city is Bureau of Environmental Services, and I'm not entirely familiar with their process, but they do have a process that by which they add, and I think they mostly just add species that can't be planted because they're nuisance, and there are certain criteria that have to be met there. And while some people do mow their lawn, and so it's hard for anything they don't want to get sprouted, not everyone does.
Right.
And the concern there is with displacement of other species that are more desirable. So that's the second part of my answer, is how big a threat is Norway maple to Ladd's addition? And from a forestry perspective, the monoculture is a concern, right? Remember that Asian longhorn beetle or whatever other creature that we don't even know about yet that may come to town at any time. And these are millions and millions of dollars of impacts that places in Connecticut, for example, are dealing with emerald ash borer, for example, so and huge public safety risks. So it's hard to imagine that, even in spite of the pictures that I showed you for that. So that's a concern we have. We use whatever list the city puts out there for nuisance species, and we're part of that process. So it is deemed to be a big risk enough to warrant being on the nuisance list.
Okay.
Yeah. All
right. Thank you. Okay. At this time, I'd like to call up some folks who are from HAND. Judith Reese, Linda, Joanne, and Henry. I mean, I guess maybe if you want to come up all four at the same time or two at a time, that would be fine. Okay, all five of you. All right. And just state your name and address for the record. Thank you, and welcome.
Technology. Oh, there we go. Good afternoon, commissioners. Henry Kanowski, 2036 Southeast Spruce Avenue in the Ladd's Addition.
Joanne Stainbrook. Ladd's Addition, 2424 Southeast Orange Avenue.
Judith Reese, 1965 Southeast Hemlock Avenue, Ladd's Addition.
I'm Toby Deming, 1943 Southeast Hemlock Avenue.
Linda Nedekoven, 2018 Southeast Ladd Avenue.
I guess I'll lead off. your commission chair, I think, gave a good brief synopsis of the significance of the Lads Edition in terms of not just locally, but on a national scale, particularly with the 2002 recognition that it falls within the category of suburban planning in the United States from 1860 to 1960, and in particular represents one of the first radial plans in the city. I'm not sure if Hillary was managed to get this document out. You got it? Okay. So you see it's even featured in on the cover of the bulletin, also an image that Jen showed. So it has a significant history from that perspective on a very broad scale. And one of the other factors that's identified is also the street tree planting plan, which the guidelines contain. I don't know if all of, well, that's again in the handout on page two. And so we have a pretty good precedent in terms of the significant factors, which include the landscape as character-defining contributing features. Even though at the time the nomination was written, and Judith was one of the authors of that nomination, the whole subject of cultural landscapes was really not on, on the screen. I don't think that arrived until maybe a year or two later, and then finally got more formalized. Now we have cultural landscape surveys along with HABs and HARE. So what was done in the guidelines really predates a lot of national standards for understanding the influence or the impact or even how to understand historic cultural landscapes. And so I think this is a factor that's worth recognizing as well. Another factor, and it was brought up by Kristen, was the fact that I don't believe it was until, I think, 2006 or 7 that the Parks Bureau conducted a cultural landscape inventory for its system, looking at roughly 250 properties. And it did go through the reconnaissance one and two level, particularly reconnaissance two level for properties that were considered likely candidates for the National Register. And that was done in part in partnership with Portland Parks and the Bureau of Planning and now Sustainability. And that, through a SHPO grant, they indicated to us that was the first time in the state that anybody had tried to take a comprehensive look at cultural landscapes in the state, other than individual listings that also had a landscape component. So even within the Bureau itself, the recognition of the significance of cultural landscapes is relatively new. So, you know, in that regard, I believe, and I believe our Hand Neighborhood and Lads Edition believe that an update of the guidelines is appropriate. And also wanted to briefly say, and others will comment more on this, this whole, the subject has at least a 10 plus year history of discussion. And there was a decision made, I think in 2014 or 15, working with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability that an update would be part of a RECAP 7 process. And at the last minute, that was taken off the agenda for various reasons. So there have been efforts in working with parks and forestry and the neighborhood and community and specialists to try to move this concept forward. And I don't want to indicate by any means that we're in disagreement with what urban forestry is saying. We've already come to some guidelines and an agreement about the nature of what would make reasonable replacements, replacement trees. So with that, I'll maybe turn it over to whoever would like to further comment. Thank you.
Maybe I'll just say a few words. I was involved in writing the original design guidelines in 1988, 30 years ago. And at that time, we worked with urban forestry to develop what the approved trees would be. The major ones that are being called out today that Jen talked about are the historic trees. This time, our best estimate was that they were planted in about 1907, so they're well over 100 years old, the ones that are surviving. That includes the maples and the elms, some of the elms. But as Jen also mentioned, you know, many things have changed over that time, and a number of the trees that were proposed for the outer perimeter of the neighborhood actually were where there was not integrity at that time that we did the design guidelines. We deferred to the current city urban forester at that time, and so where you'd see single seed hawthorn and a variety of pear and other kinds of plum trees, and the golden desert ash on Division, those were actually proposed by city staff, and we deferred to them because of the lack of integrity of the edges. Since that time, most of those have not survived. The desert ashes have, I think there may be two remaining in all of the length of Division Street from 12th to 20th. And the concern about the American elm, Save Our Elms has worked long and hard to find exactly what you were asking for, something that looks like it, smells like it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been working off a list since, I believe, 2014 to work with varieties, different varieties of elms. And maybe, Toby, you'd like to say more about that.
Yeah. So I'm one of the original founders of Save Our Elms, which was a group that actually came off of FLAG, which was handling the rose gardens. We started handling the trees when we started losing American elms to Dutch elm disease. And as you know from history on the East Coast, they have not held up well. They were actually brought here, planted. They were not native. They didn't survive. A lot of things don't. We still have quite a few that are surviving, and we've worked very hard to maintain those. We're going away from inoculations because we don't believe that inoculation is as effective in protecting them as pruning. So we work very closely with forestry right now to try to keep them pruned, keep dead wood out. And so far, excuse me, we've been fairly successful. I think, you know, 100 years, you know, at the time they were planted, seemed like a good idea. Time the American or the birch were planted seemed like a good idea. The European birch is a garbage tree. So, and we're thrilled to have, that's actually not even on our list now. With the help of Urban Forestry and Schmidt's Nursery, we now plant what's called a Giacomani birch, which is a much more upright, structurally sound birch. We haven't planted European birch since I've been on the committee. So last 20 years, we have not planted them. So, you know, we've got this list, but we aren't necessarily following up because it's not current. And so with working with Urban Forestry, we've been developing it. Nobody's ever put it down in writing and made it part of the code. The Norway maple is defined as an invasive species. So we worked with Urban Forestry to come up with two maples that are acceptable to them. One of them is a State Street maple. And so we have been planting that in the larger parking strips that can handle a bigger tree. And it is a maple. It has a similar color, similar shape, similar taste, all those things. In the smaller strips where those are designated as maples, we're planting what's called a Pacific Sunset maple. It's a smaller maple, won't be as disruptive to sidewalks and things like that. it actually isn't a yellow tree, but it was something that both urban forestry and the neighborhood felt would be acceptable for that. So we've got a pattern of working with urban forestry to come up with a tree that we think maintains the integrity. The last tree code mandated that we work with urban forestry. We've had a number of meetings with urban forestry, and so it has not gone, you know, disregarded. And we have tried to keep that going and would like to continue to keep that going. So I'm assuming that beeping was for me. And if you want to hear more, you know, I'll let you know whatever you want to know.
Okay. I'd like to address one other thing besides the species, and that is the consistency of planting a single species along a street. And as you could see from the photographs that Jen showed of Ladd's Addition and how wonderful the neighborhood is, that is a really, that is really an important characteristic of the neighborhood and was defined, you know, when we did the National Register nomination, and I believe is one of the major elements that would go to the national landmark status of the neighborhood as well. I know that it's something that they do not want to see citywide, obviously, but there's no way with a diverse planting plan that you can get that kind of arcade. And what is always kind of curious and hard for us to understand is why, you know, they have the policy for city streets that are residential streets, but when it comes to planting Nato Parkway or the cherry trees in Waterfront Park, you have a single species, and there again you see that beautiful design element of the arcades. The cherry trees in North Waterfront Park this year were marvelous, and originally there was only one line of those planted, so the city has planted a second line of them. So we hope that that is something that will not be lost in developing revised guidelines for the neighborhood.
Yeah, I think one thing that hasn't been defined that we've been trying to get defined is what is a monoculture? Because all of our street trees exist for two blocks and then they change. So is a monoculture two trees in a row? Mm-hmm. Is it 10? Is it 20? And I think, I mean, if we were trying to plan for 10,000 years, then all these things are important. But as we can see from the best intentions 100 years ago, things change. And it's just hard to have it both ways.
Go ahead. One quick addition to that, I live on an Elm Street and have helped with inoculations in the past, but my end of the block is also filled with Japanese maples, and they're all on private property, but people come at, you know, various times of year to photograph those trees because they're quite lovely, and those have all been planted independently by the residents of that area. So it's, I mean, it's this funny mix of things in terms of defining what monoculture means or where the risks are and what we can do to mitigate them.
So, I mean, I think you all raised really great questions. And what it, to me at least, what it boils down to a need for is not necessarily a revision of guidelines, but more like a management plan for the landscape. Because regardless of what, that landscape is always changing, you know, and we have to kind of plan for succession. Eventually those old trees are going to go away, and you want to know what's going to replace them. And it should be consistent. You know, that follows that same kind of design ethic. And the more we can engage, you know, forestry in this discussion, and without compromising the ideas of monoculture or invasive species, and come up with some solutions, because I think you all have been working pretty hard to kind of come up with those solutions. It seems like we just need to have a meeting of the minds and develop management plan that's specific for Lad's Addition, because it is, you know, in my eyes, nationally significant. And it would really be a shame to kind of lose that character that it currently has. So.
And we have been talking about options at the staff level. Mm-hmm. I have to apologize for Jen Cairo. She thought she was going to be out of here half an hour ago, and she had another obligation, so she had to leave. But I can ask her some of these questions and forward responses to you.
So, okay, sorry, go ahead, Joanne.
I just wanted to speak on behalf of all the good work that Save Our Elms has done in the neighborhood to preserve the integrity of the design of the landscape. I'm a second generation Lads resident, and I started planting trees when I was 12. So it's been really important to me to preserve the canopy. So I respect the work that forestry does, but I think the conversation that's been missing here is the more theoretical cultural landscapes conversation, and we need to marry those two discussions in a thoughtful way. And so I think the management plan is important. And I think one of the things that Jen Cairo didn't have time to talk about or didn't talk about was the relationship with Save Our Elms, that they have more at the staff level. And so the Norway maple has not been planted in quite a while since that ban took effect. And the State Street maple is now a good replacement, and we do have options for these. But I think it has to be more of a thought out conversation, and it having all parties at the table.
Perfect.
Last piece that's critical, and then I'll shut up. It's great to have a plan. But you heard everybody talking and pointing fingers, who's going to enforce it? That's been a frustration of Lad's Addition since I moved in, is that we have a plan, it's been recognized by the city, but the foresters don't have any policy or teeth to uphold the plan. And so you get a neighbor who doesn't understand it or isn't unwilling, and they plant whatever they want. That's been a huge problem for us. I mean, you try to maintain it, and then you either get a bureaucracy or a neighbor, and it's been a combination of both. And I will point the fingers. So I'm really anxious for us to work this out and then give whoever's going to be in charge. I don't care who's in charge. But somebody has to have a map and say, no, you're on LAD. You're supposed to plant. Can't plant American elms anymore, but we have these other elms that are all disease resistant. They all meet the standards, so here's your tree. So I'm hoping that some teeth will come out of this and not just a plan that's floating out there for somebody like us to read.
I think there are other districts that have components in them that are not necessarily regulated by this body. I mean, for instance, they have light standards or other components in the rights of way, and those just have to be folded into it is partly the guidelines, but it's also partly sort of a non-standard elements in the right-of-way. What am I trying to think of? Not elements. At any rate, thank you. So I think we should definitely have more conversations with staff about how this management plan, if you will, can be folded into kind of a non-standard components in the right-of-way type agreement and make sure that there is enforcement, because I completely agree with Chair Renzetta. This is a neighborhood that has the potential to become a National Historic Landmark, and we want to see that happen. And it's gratifying that there's so much talent and experience with your all of you sitting here being involved. That's great.
We do have some of those elements, the horse rings, for example.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess just to wrap up, I mean, I think that there is a way to kind of manage this in such a manner that we can raise public awareness, we can make sure that there's no jurisdictional squabbles or uncertainties to really be able to make people think twice about what they want to do in the planting strip, for instance, so that, you know, things are done deliberately. And you know, just I think that having an active neighborhood association and an organization dedicated to it is a great first step. And I mean, I totally appreciate the amount of effort that you all have put into that. I mean, really is incredible. So made a big difference.
So just to move forward, I will continue to keep the commission updated as to conversations that we're having with urban forestry. And I think that listing an update to the LEDS edition guidelines in your state of the city could be something that we can discuss and maybe.
I have some fears with that, just in the current environment.
Sure, but it doesn't hurt to wave the flag and say this is something that needs to be done. It's not just you asking, it's urban forestry that's asking, it's neighborhood, so.
Right.
Okay.
Anything final from you guys, or nope? Okay. All right, thank you.
That's great. Thank you.
Appreciate it again, everything you guys do. Okay. So we're running a little bit behind.